Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Yuri Maricich, an internal medicine physician and the Chief Medical Officer and Head of Development at Pear Therapeutics. He joined the show to discuss the current use of digital therapeutics for insomnia, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, the state of education and treatment for the sleep disorder, and some of the challenges in care, as well as many other topics. So without further ado, let's dive in.
Hi, my name is Yuri Maricich. I'm an internal medicine physician and also the Chief Medical Officer and Head of Development at Pear Therapeutics. We know that sleep is critically important to health. Good sleep or lack of good sleep can have a big impact on multiple other organ systems and diseases. So cardiovascular, neurologic, particularly things like epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, infectious disease, and mental health. And there's been a lot of work looking at the importance of and what is addressed in the clinical guidelines as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. But unfortunately, the vast majority of patients can't get access because there's only approximately 600 clinicians who are trained and less than 400 who are even certified. So the vast majority of patients don't have access to clinicians, and there are some states that don't even have clinicians. And so there's been a lot of work around developing things like digital cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia delivered through software via an app. And there's a whole approach called prescription digital therapeutics that delivers to those patients. And much of that research has been done in randomized control trials. And so really the interest in this study was to one, look at a real world patient population who are just using this as part of everyday practice. And also to look at not just the clinical outcomes, but also the health economic outcomes, particularly the impact from claims via looking at insurance, both Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial, to better understand what is the impact on utilization of different types of services like ER visits, inpatient stays, medication, and what are the overall cost savings?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously the lack of availability is definitely enough of interest on its own. And then adding in sort of the potential economic information is super important. So what ultimately, you know, did you guys find when you conducted this assessment, and did anything stand out that was like particularly surprising to you, or like, hey, this is something we didn't expect to see?
Sure. So I would say first off, just as background, is that the research was done in a real world population. So as I mentioned, this is built on and attempting to assess, okay, we've studied this in controlled trials. We have an understanding when we can pick the appropriate patient population that we think is most appropriate and most likely to map the population of interest, which are patients with chronic insomnia, but two, compared to a control setting, all getting delivery of the intervention within those constraints. Here, we wanted to just say, look, let's just look at all comers. And so the way we did that was by matching. We actually had over 7,000 patients that we've actually previously published on who were treated with the prescription digital therapeutic for chronic insomnia. And then what we did is we matched those to their claims, and we looked at the 24 months pre compared to the 24 months post. And so a couple findings when we looked at the difference between the pre period of treatment in patients with chronic insomnia and then after they got the prescription digital therapeutic, we looked at those 24 months post, was one, that clinicians and patients are actually using digital cognitive behavioral therapy via PDT. So that was one finding. Two was from a clinical perspective, there is a low number needed to treat, which is the ratio of number of patients who need to be treated to achieve a particular clinical endpoint. And in the publication, we highlighted this was 1.7, which means you need to treat basically 1.7 patients for them to be a responder, and 3.8 was the number needed to treat to be a remitter, which means essentially that they are cured, which is not common in a chronic disease. So that was on the clinical side. On the economic side, we saw a 53% reduction in ER visits and a 21% reduction in hospitalization, with an overall cost reduction of $2,059 per patient in the 2 years afterwards. And then lastly, we also saw a reduction in sleep aid medication use, which dropped 18.5%. So those were some of the top line findings. I think the thing that surprised me the most about this was actually the reduction in ER and inpatient use. We had seen before in some of the clinical trials, the clinical impact. We'd seen before the reduction in medications, but in my experience as an internal medicine physician, you know, I'm familiar with patients, for example, with severe neurologic diseases like Parkinson's or heart failure ending up in the hospital or the ER, but it was not commonplace for me to expect patients with poor sleep end up in the ER. And I think what we were detecting in the study is that many of these patients had had chronic insomnia for years, like 6+ years. And so the cumulative effect of poor sleep that leads to chronic insomnia then leads to other poor health, which then eventually does result in patients utilizing the emergency room, utilizing inpatient care. And so to me, that was really the most surprising aspect of the findings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, just considering too, how common insomnia can be, you know, there are plenty of chronic disease patient populations who would benefit from having their insomnia addressed or whatever their sleep problem may be. And then I'm curious again, like, you know, kind of broad strokes, it seems like a lot of positive findings out of this on both the outcome side and the economic side. But speaking to the economics, because to your point, particularly when we're talking about patients who have had this for a lot, been dealing with this for a long period of time and are, you know, at some point at least ending up in inpatient care situations, you know, what impact do you think that this could have if we're able to implement this on a wider scale for these patients? You know, seeing just the downturn in needs to visit the hospital, you know, do you foresee that potentially being mirrored in, if this were, say, available tomorrow nationwide for everyone with insomnia?
Right. It's a really important question. And I think the sad thing is that sleep in general is oftentimes deprioritized by many clinicians. Unless you personally have experienced significant chronic insomnia, and I don't mean a difficult night's sleep. We all have those, but someone who has sustained difficulty impairing ultimately their ability to function long-term, we just don't prioritize that. But to your point, if this were something that we could roll out, because right now we don't have good treatment options. Like as I went through training, it was basically like, yeah, you could get someone into CBTI, but by the way, it's almost impossible. So typically you're going to have to resort to medications, and those are not good long-term treatment options. And so if we could roll this out, I think one, we would have clinicians who would now actually have a treatment option that is consistent with the guidelines that they can get into patients' hands. And then to your point, in addition to the clinical benefit, I think we would see reduction if the findings from this study are generalizable, which was the purpose of doing this in a real world population, are generalizable to seeing that benefit both in reducing patients having to go to the ER, reducing inpatient, and hopefully reducing overall cost to the health system, which is in a huge need now because so many of the treatments we have add to the cost of the healthcare system. So when we find things that can actually lower cost, we're really killing two birds with one stone, so to speak.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting because, again, it does seem like the data on these types of interventions has really started to roll out a little bit more in the past couple of years. And just sleep medicine as a whole, the understanding of sleep and the effects that it can have on other diseases and just kind of human beings in general, that science has really ramped up as well in the last decade or two. And it seems like we're starting to prioritize it more. But to your point, it hasn't totally translated to that 100% we're addressing this constantly. I'm curious for you, why do you think that there has been such a slow uptick in especially something like this that is guideline recommended? We have the data to prove that it does work. Why do you think there is such a slow uptick in the utilization of these types of therapies, particularly ones that seem to be translatable to a digital model where they in theory would be more accessible?
Right. I think it, right now, Matt, because we're still early in this whole modality of prescription digital therapeutics, it's education, but it's also what you highlighted earlier, which is sleep. So I think that in general, we need more education on the importance of sleep. How do we assess sleep? Do we talk about it with our patients? Is it something that we think is important on the problem list? Then do we know what are available treatment options? If we do in fact screen for it or address it directly, it's not something saved till the end of the visit. It's kind of like a throwaway thing. It's like, this is important. This is part of assessing a patient's health. And I know this is going to have impact across these different domains of the patient and other problems we're addressing. And then two, I still talk to clinicians every week who are not familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia or it being first line. And then third, no one taught me how to write a prescription for software when I went through training. And so we still need lots of education to say, look, we now have a whole new set of treatment tools that are prescription digital therapeutics, and they might not be available for everyone or the most appropriate for everyone, but for many patients, there's now data to suggest that patients will use these, and then training as to how to use them, just like any new treatment option that comes out. How do I educate my patient on it? How do I integrate it into my visit?
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Marisich to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, Eisai and Biogen have announced positive findings for lecanemab, previously known as BAN2401, in the Phase 3 Clarity AD trial. Ultimately, the drug reduced decline in the clinical dementia rating sum of boxes scores by 27% compared with placebo from baseline to month 18 for participants with early Alzheimer's disease, according to positive top-line results. More details are expected to be presented at the Clinical Trials in Alzheimer's Disease Congress later this year. Next, verdiperstat, Biohaven's investigational MPO enzyme inhibitor, failed to statistically differentiate itself from placebo in newly announced findings from the pivotal Healy ALS platform trial. In a brief company update, it was noted that the agent did not reach statistical significance for differences on pre-specified primary outcomes of disease progression, nor survival and other key secondary measures. The full results of the study are expected to be presented at an upcoming scientific conference. Next, also from the Healy ALS platform, more top-line findings announced in the last 2 weeks demonstrated that CNMAU8, an investigational agent from Clean Nanomedicine, also did not meet its primary and secondary endpoints. However, the therapy did show survival benefit on exploratory analyses. Additional pre-specified exploratory analyses of both the trial and the open label extension are expected to be shared once available, according to the investigators. And finally, also in ALS news, the FDA has approved Amylyx Pharmaceuticals AMX-35, a co-formulation of sodium phenylbutyrate and taurursodiol for the treatment of the disease. The drug, which will now be marketed as Relyvrio, becomes the third approved therapy to help slow disease progression or mortality in ALS, following Riluzole in 1995 and Edaravone in 2017. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Maricich.
Looking at the study, you know, there was a separation, it seems, a little bit between those who had been previously treated for their sleep issues versus those who were treatment naive. And I'm curious, did you guys identify any particular differences between those subgroups? You know, did those who had, you know, been treated prior, did they perhaps see more benefit from this, or were they kind of both in line? I'm just, like I said, curious if there were any differences between those groups.
Yeah, it's an important question. We've looked at that in some other studies, because for many chronic diseases, it does appear that treatment overall can be cumulative. So the more treatment a patient gets, the better their response will be versus a treatment naive. We didn't look at that specifically in this study. We did ask patients whether or not they had used medication, and then we looked at that by looking at their pharmacy claims. And we saw 52% of the patients had used sleep medication previously. So that meant that basically a little over half had already received some form of treatment for their sleep medication. But we're looking forward to additional analyses where we'll be, I think, more directly analyzing that kind of question. And particularly to your point, is not just the difference between previous treatment and treatment naive, but then what are the characteristics or attributes of those patients that help us to identify likelihood of response? And then that can help guide clinicians to better understand who's the patient who might be most appropriate for this and most likely to respond.
Yeah. And you know, on the clinical side of this too, again, speaking to these patients, you know, a lot of them, it does seem like, yeah, like you said, 52% had been treated or were on a medication of some type. So do you see a potential for this type of tool for CBTI for insomnia to kind of be maybe not the only intervention that's utilized, but almost as a supplement to existing care? And do you think that that could help perhaps with that wider adoption of, hey, you know, we're not getting the total response that we want to see from medication, or, you know, there's adherence issues, or, you know, the patient, you know, is having some adverse effects they don't really enjoy dealing with. Can we supplement that current treatment with a program like this?
Yes. So in some of the prior RCTs we looked at, we found one RCT was similar number. It was done in the US, 50% of the patients were treated with sleep medication, and then they got the digital cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia via the PDT. And we saw a reduction in medication use. And then we've also in RCTs, both in the US and abroad, looked at patients who were not on sleep medication. So I think that's a really important point. And it can then help as a clinician, because now you have two treatment options. And particularly since medication are not recommended for long-term use, it can be a way to bring that up, slowly titrate that down. And then I can also share in many of my conversations, particularly with sleep experts, many of them do see patients who are referred to them with polypharmacy. So they have multiple medications, they have drug-drug interactions. And that's the question is, can you help titrate this patient off some of these medications? And so I think something like this, it's not very useful, I think, clinically for a poor patient if they show up and we say, hey, we're going to stop all your medications. And they're like, and what about my sleep? So now there's hopefully another tool to say, we're going to do this, start it while you're on your medication. And then that can give us an approach to titrate off some of those other medications.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, even if, like you said, even if it's just getting down from, hey, we're on three treatments, we can get you down to maybe one or two, even that's enough to improve. Then you talk about quality of life and just the burden of treatment in general. And obviously, it sounds like there's some further analyses that are planned, some additional things that you were at least interested in looking into. So I'm curious, you know, at this stage for you, whether it's something that is planned to do an analysis on or just something that you think would be worth exploring, you know, what else in this area around these digital therapeutics do you think is worth looking into over the next couple of years?
I love the question. So I can mention two areas that we're actively working on that you can look forward to more data coming out. One is comparison to a control. So this was a real-world analysis looking at a pre-post, and we're looking forward to publishing data looking at basically a similar type of analysis, but compared to a control population. The second is also digging into the details around pharmacotherapy, like we discussed. And so we're looking to share data both in clinical trials, but also in the real world, and looking at greater degree of details around sleep medication use. I think a third area that we are doing, but I think that there's a huge need for the entire field, is to look further at how different care models and the integration of digital treatments like PDTs can be utilized to improve access, but also to help support clinicians in delivering care in new ways, right? So given the advent of telemedicine now being more ubiquitous, given patients having access to mobile devices, I think there's a real opportunity for us to weave through synchronous care, be it face-to-face or in front of a video or audio, versus asynchronous care. And then how do those complement each other? What are the right patient populations? How do we respond? So I think this type of implementation science research, there's just a huge opportunity here for us to better then help us refine how do we deliver care better.
Yeah, and then obviously that can help lend itself to improving the adoption of these types of tools. So, and I'm curious for you, one of the last things I want to ask you, and of course, if there's anything else, feel free to add. But you know, what's your message to that clinical community? Because the thing about sleep too that I find so interesting is that, you know, again, we on for us in our conversations that we're having, a lot of times we're speaking to the neurology perspective to sleep. So we're talking about sort of the central nervous system's role and the brain's role and all the things that are assessed there. But, you know, to your point, sleep is essential to internal medicine. It's essential to pulmonologists. It's essential to the primary care group, the family medicine doctors. You know, everyone has patients who sleep, and sleep can, as we're now finding out more and more of, impact all these things. So this is a tool that I imagine could not only be useful for those neurologists and pulmonologists who are focusing on these specific things, but you know, perhaps the community doctor who doesn't have access to those specialists. So for you, what's kind of the pitch to explore these tools, or at least to look into the potential benefit of these tools on a just to improve the day-to-day care of these patients?
Right. I mean, I think I'll be a little bit glib, but I think clinicians in general, given the fact that during their training, their own sleep was ignored. And so it's not surprising that sometimes that is one of the areas we tend to overlook because we overlook it for ourself. And so I think just echoing again, it is so important for us to address sleep. Like we need to first and foremost standardize assessing patient sleep. And actually, there, all clinicians, specialists, primary care clinicians can do that. But primary care is really the first line. So I think standardizing how can we assess sleep upfront, is that something we ask about? But specialists should do it equally because it does have such an impact on whatever disease area they're focused on. And then I do think specialists are, though, a very important group because they oftentimes can help set what are those best practices for their primary care peers, right? So primary care has to know so much so wide. And so if they're talking with their neurologist or their sleep medication, their sleep physician or their psychiatrist, and they hear, oh, by the way, I wanted to get patient off of Zolpidem and I use this prescription digital therapeutic, this is a way that we can help have specialists continue that education, as well as primary care clinicians share that with their specialists friends. So I really think it's bi-directional there. And then also sharing best practices around how to just use this in daily practice. And you know, as a clinician, when you look at the data, you can oftentimes quickly make an assessment. Is this something I should be using? But then the question is, how do I use that? And again, this being so new, that's where I think that kind of robust discussion amongst peers is really important for us to share best practices.
Yeah, and hopefully we, again, as you know, time goes on and more data like this comes out, that hopefully those conversations pick up and then we start to see a bit wider spread adoption. You know, the floor is yours. Any closing thoughts or you know, additional bits of information you think are important to include?
I think we covered most of it. I would say maybe the three things that we kind of highlighted, but just to reinforce, Matt, is one, you know, we talked about sleep is just super important and, you know, standardizing, addressing it. Two is that because the guidelines recommend CBTI, but most patients don't get it, that digital treatments like prescription digital therapeutics is an opportunity to help get more patients guideline recommended care. And then I think three on the data from the study is both on the clinical side. You know, I was really surprised with the number needed to treat being so low. You want to know when you treat someone that, you know, what's their likelihood of getting benefit from it. And so when we start getting below 10, we start getting interested. When we start getting below 5, you get really excited. And so this was a good number. And then knowing that what we're doing with any treatment is overall having a positive impact on the health ecosystem, particularly overall utilization of care and cost. I think that's a big added plus because we're all looking to be more aware of the impact we are on the overall cost of healthcare.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.